The Holding Court podcast is powered by Fundraising University Ohio. Fundraising University Ohio offers a variety of fundraising efforts that help basketball teams run profitable, effective, and fast-paced fundraisers designed to raise the most money in the shortest amount of time to reach their fundraising goals. Fundraising University Ohio is locally owned and operated, and with their six-step blitz system, will help your team maximize profits. As a former basketball coach himself, Brent Maxwell will sit down and help you pick, plan, strategize, and execute your fundraiser, which will allow you as a coach to devote more time to the other aspects of your program. If you're looking to take your fundraising efforts to the next level, contact Brent Maxwell at bmaxwell@fundraisingu.net or 740-501-8946 to learn more. Welcome to Holding Court, presented by the Ohio High School Basketball Coaches Association. Join hosts Adam Hall and Walt Serrato as they sit down with some of the biggest names in Ohio high school basketball and beyond. This show and all of our shows are available to listen to completely free anywhere that you can find podcasts. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Let's get to it.
Hello, it's Adam Hall here with my co-host Walt Serrato. And we are excited to be joined by Michael Bates, current head boys basketball coach at Columbus Apocentric Early College. Coach, thank you for joining us and welcome to the Holding Court podcast.
Thank you for having me. Really looking forward to spending this time having this conversation with you guys. I'm really excited about sharing with people what Afrocentric basketball is all about, but then also letting people know about our school and my story. So I'm excited about the opportunity.
Awesome, Coach. Well, before we jump into it, hey, a huge shout out to your girls program on winning a Division III state title and head coach Janisha Anderson. I know you work closely with her throughout the season, and maybe just talk to us a little bit about her team and maybe some things that you've learned as a coach by observing her and her team that have made you better.
The amount of time and work that those young ladies put in, I think that my program spends a lot of time in the gym, but those girls are there just as much, if not more than us, all the time. And so, you know, just the level of one of the big things that I pull from her is the attention to details. She's extremely detail focused in her practice and even in her shoot arounds. Like, her game day shoot arounds are phenomenal. It's like a practice. It's so focused. It's intentional. It's purposeful and it's deliberate. And I love it. And I think that's one of the things that I take away most from her. Is just her attention to the details and then just how intentional she is about the things that she does and the things that she teaches those young ladies. So, you know, once again, congratulations, big time congratulations. And not just for her, it's her second one. It's back to back on top of that. We all know how tough that is. But it's the ninth state championship in our girls program history. And for that to be done since the first year that we actually had varsity athletics at Afrocentric was 2003, 2004. And so since that time, to have nine state championships and you know, 12 final championship game appearances is just phenomenal. It's phenomenal. It's actually, to me, it's a documentary waiting to happen. It's a 30 for 30. But to see it done day to day to day to day and with different young ladies over the course of these two decades, it's absolutely amazing. I'm so proud of them and so proud for our school community.
So, Coach, before we go any further, you hit on it. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about that game day walkthrough, okay? You talked about what you've observed with Coach Anderson. Kind of anxious to kind of get, you know, your thoughts on what does your game day walkthrough look like? How important is that for your teams? You know, there's two philosophies right now. Some teams are going away from the game day walk. Just show up and play the game. While others still think that's very important, and just going through things one more time with your team. Where do you stand on that? What's your philosophies, and what do you feel is those the most effective?
You know, to be totally honest with you, fellas, I really think that it depends on the players that you have in your locker room. You know, if you have a group that's focused and you got it, y'all went through it, you went through a hard practice on Thursday night in preparation for a big game on Friday, and you really broke everything down and you went through every scenario and all of the different looks that you're going to be facing the next day, and they can retain that information, then maybe that next day on that Friday, we just doing a shoot around. We're not really going to spend time on a walkthrough. Whereas then you have other times where you have other teams, like the team that I had this year, where we need to go back and do a review. You know, we need to review again what we talked about last night to just make sure that it's fresh in their minds for what we're about to face here coming up in the next couple of hours. So, you know, to me, it really depends on that team that you have. A couple of years ago, the last 2 years, you know, when Daylon Swain was here for me my last couple of years, we could go over everything at that previous night in practice, and we'd be good to go and just need to do a little shoot around the next day. This team that I had this year, where we had to do a whole lot more teaching this year, we had to do reviews on those game days. So I really think it really depends on the players that you have in your locker room at the time.
Well, Coach, let's jump right into it then. Let's talk about your team this year. 14-10, looking at your schedule, seemed to be in most games until the end, in all but a few. And obviously, Daylon Swain, huge loss, two-time Division III player of the year, big-time player at Xavier University, getting big minutes, important minutes for Xavier this year. So I'm sure that was an adjustment. I guess, how tough of an adjustment was that for you? And what are a few things as you look back through your season that maybe you wish you would have done different?
You lose a generational type of player at a school like Afrocentric in Daylon Swain. After having him for 4 years, you know, it's definitely going to be a drop off in regards to the talent that you have inside the building at the time. And so there was an adjustment to come back to not having a top 100 player in the country in the gymnasium to give the ball to at tough times. And so this year we relied a little bit more on our system, on trying to develop our players, you know, throughout the course of the year. But like in games, we had to rely more on our plays than we had to rely on our players, which was a little bit different for me for the last couple of years. When you got a player like Daylon Swain, you know, sometimes you can't outsmart yourself. Sometimes you just got to give it to him and let him go to work. You know what I'm saying? Just, hey, give it to him, clear it out, maybe run a high ball screen, and then let him diagnose what he wants to do and let him go do his thing. All right. And so having that luxury for the last couple of years, you know, that was a big time luxury to have. So this year we had to rely a little bit more on our systems that we had in place. And it was also a big teaching year because our players this year were young. You know, I returned basically two seniors, a few juniors, and a bunch of sophomores this year. I only had three players that actually returned from last year's team that actually have playing time in the state tournament games and things of that nature. So it was a very young team. So it was basically Cortez Freeman, who hopefully he'll be like he'll be an all-state player in Division III. I had Cortez. He was my only returning starter from last year's team. And then Chris Cooper Patton, who was a reserve player the previous year, and Makai Johnson, a reserve player the previous year. They all had to step in. So I only really had three players from last year's varsity team. And then the rest of the team was my JV team from last year. So it was a big time teaching year for us. There's a lot of teaching going on. And I don't know, you know, you all coaching, you all know how it is. Sometimes when you're teaching, it can be fun. But a lot of times when you're teaching, it's frustrating as hell. And this year, you know, it got to that point. Sometimes it's like we keep saying the same things over and over. But you just got to keep on grinding on them until they really understand it. Because the only reason they're not doing it is because they don't understand it. So it's just, I had to just reteach things a lot of times and just had to reteach them in different ways in order to try to get the point across. And towards the end of the year, we were really starting to trend in the right direction. And I'm really excited about what the future holds for our team next year.
So, Coach, let's stay in the present here a little bit and kind of talk about some of these significant changes that we're seeing to high school basketball in Ohio. You know, maybe some ones that we kind of saw be implemented this past year and what's coming in the future. So that being said, give us your thoughts on the Max Preps RPI rating system.
You're talking about a bombshell. That was a bombshell. And it was felt all across the state, you know what I mean, in a lot of different ways. I think that the concept in itself is okay. I think that there needs to be tweaks to that system this year, because if the tweaks aren't made, then everybody is going to have to adjust how they schedule, you know what I'm saying, moving forward. And so one of the big things, I like I said, I think it's okay. I don't really have a problem with it per se. I like that it's standardized across the board for everybody. That's the one thing I do like. I do like that it's the same for everybody across. But I do think that that some changes need to be made to the RPI. And the reason why I say that is this. You could have two teams that are both Division III that are 14-6, but they're totally different 14-6s. For instance, I'll use my team as an example. We were 12-8 this year, but my 12-8 isn't like everybody else's 12-8. You know, my 12-8 had a lot of Division I 12 losses on it. And, you know, but it also had some very good Division I wins on there. Not very many Division III teams could go in and beat a Pick Central this year on a neutral floor or beat a Westerville South on a neutral floor. But that win that I had over Pick Central and that win that I had over Westerville South in the current formulation and the way that the ratings are set up, it's no different than the win that I had against a team that might have been winless for the season. You know what I mean? So like the 12-8 is not the same 12-8 across the board. And that's where when coaches were voting on the seeding, coaches respected the schedules and they knew certain wins were great wins and certain losses were not bad losses. You know what I mean? Right now, a loss is a loss and a win is a win. And so you could really go out and coaches really could, if they wanted to, they could really go out and set up a schedule where they could just schedule as many wins as possible on their schedule and they'll get a higher seed. Now, that might not necessarily help their team go further in the tournament, you know what I mean? Because they played a weaker schedule and they didn't play the type of competition that would help prepare them for the tournament. But they could really position themselves so that they could get a higher seed in the tournament. And I think that that's something that needs to be addressed when they go back and look at this first year and see how it went.
Coach, I appreciate your honesty and feedback with that process. The next thing is, next year, we will be expanding divisions. We will go from 4 to 7. Your opinion, good thing, bad thing, and why?
I think it's good. And this is the reason why I say that I think it's good. We have about 800 high schools that play varsity basketball. You know, right around 800. Okay. And we probably have around 750, 800 high schools that play varsity football. And in varsity football, they've had 7 divisions for a little while now. To me, it kind of should be, once again, it's one of those things where if the numbers are the same, let's standardize it across. Let's just standardize it across the board. Because to win the state championship, whether you have 7 divisions, whether you have 4 divisions, whether you had 3 divisions back in the day or 2 a long time ago, to win the state championship is an awesome accomplishment, and it's going to be extremely hard to do. It's going to be extremely hard to do whether you have 4 divisions or whether you have 7 divisions. It's still going to be tough. You know, you're still going to have some hard, tough matchups. I do think that it'll be more fair for a lot of the teams that were in Division I with that numbers disparity in Division I. But I also, people don't realize this also, there's a big numbers disparity also in division four, you know, between the top and the bottom. You know, it could be a big time disparity there as well. So I think that it'll help address some of the disparity issues in regards to the numbers, but then also it'll standardize things across the board. Because, you know, basketball actually has the most teams, boys basketball probably has the most teams that participate in a state tournament, and everybody gets to participate. Whereas in football, they have a few less teams than basketball, but they have 7 divisions while we only have 4. So I think it'll be good regardless. You know, I think, like I said, to win the state championship is going to be tough. Doesn't matter if it's 7 divisions, 3 divisions, 4 divisions, 1 division. Winning the state championship is going to be extremely difficult, and I don't think by expanding it to 7 that's going to make it any easier, to be totally honest with you. I don't think it makes it any easier at all. I just think it gives more opportunities for teams to win championships, that's all.
So, Coach, you grew up in a teaching and coaching family. Your dad, Leroy Bates, was a Hall of Fame coach at Toledo Libby High School. Your brother, Jason Bates, is current head boys basketball coach at Pickerington North. Talk to us about some of your earliest memories being around the game. And was there a particular moment, or maybe just in general, where you said, I'm going to follow the same path as dad did?
It's funny you should ask that question about my dad and my brother. First off, you know, I got the losing record to both of those guys. I was fortunate enough to get to play my dad a couple of times before he retired. Lost both of them blowout fashions. I've been hoping that he actually got back into coaching so I could jump on him one time just so I could get a win in against him. But he ain't coming back. But then my brother, I'm also down to him as well. So love my family, you know, love coaching, love the whole coaching part of our family. I kind of knew I wanted to be a coach. I grew up in Toledo, went to St. Francis de Sales High School. And my freshman year, I actually got cut from the basketball team. So I got cut my freshman year. And my dad was, at the time, he had just accepted the coaching job at Toledo Scott as a freshman coach. That was his first high school coaching job. And so I got cut from St. Francis. So I just used to go to his practices. He used to make me come to his practices and I work out and play and practice with them guys. And when Scott had a game against a team that St. Francis played, one time he asked me, they were playing Rogers. St. Francis was playing Rogers, Toledo Rogers. And my dad was like, hey, Mike, I need you to take some notes on that Rogers team for me. Take some notes. Tell me what they run. Tell me some of the stuff that they do. And tell me when you get home from the game. And I was like, all right, cool. So I had a little notebook, pulled it out. I was at the game. I'm a freshman. I'm writing notes in one of those little flip pad books. And I'm just writing down plays and drawing up stuff that I think that they're running. I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm just trying to get as much information down for him as possible. And I came home. I gave it to him. He loved what I gave him. And then from that point on, I was hooked. I want to be a coach. I want to do this. This is fun. Like, I really enjoyed it. And so I knew when I was a freshman in high school, cut from the freshman basketball team, I had to go to my dad's practices just to get a little run in. And I started scouting for him. So I used to go to our home games at St. Francis and really scout the opponents for my dad. That's how I got started in coaching.
So, Coach, in reading up about your father, I came across a video of him speaking where he talked about the importance of connecting with your players and how that allows you to push them because they know you love them and you want to see something better for them. He also talked about the importance of being faithful to the young men that you coach through their ups and downs, because kids are going to make mistakes. They're kids. They're learning. There's going to be ups and downs, highs and lows. My question is this: in what ways has your father kind of indirectly influenced and impacted your program at AfroCentric?
I can't say that he indirectly influenced, because he directly influences us all the time. Like, when I say I talk to my dad all the time about basketball and AfroCentric basketball, it's constant. Like, he might as well be on the staff. He's in Toledo, but we talk every night. He'll call me and just be like, hey, how did practice go today? Or how did Chris do it in practice? Like, he knows the players, everything about them. So, you know, he's impacting them every day. And at the same time, what he showed me and what he talked about is that, you know, if you love them hard, you know, I tell my players and their parents this at our parent meetings is that, you know, I'm going to love your kid for 22 hours a day. I'm going to love them unbelievably. Like, I'm gonna do everything I can to help them be as successful as I can possibly make them. If something is going on, I want to shield them from anything that could be harmful to them. But for those 2 hours of practice, we gotta go. You know, we got some stuff we gotta accomplish, and I don't want to. We don't want any excuses about it. We want to get right to it. And it's gonna be hard coaching. It's gonna be in your face. It's gonna be pushing. We're going to be trying to get the most out of you, but not in a disrespectful manner, but always in a manner where we're trying to push you to be the best possible person that you could be. And I got that from him. You know, I can push you hard like that if the other 22 hours a day, I'm loving you. I'm giving you everything that you need. I'm trying to help you be the best possible person that you could be, whether it's in the classroom or socially at home. Or if it's something with your relationships with your friends or with girls or whatever the case may be, whatever I can do to help better your life outside of basketball and I'm doing those things, then it'll allow you to open up to me and let me really coach you. So, you know, you gotta love them hard in order to coach them hard. That's for sure.
I love that, Coach. That's awesome. So let's talk about before you took over for the head job at AfroCentric. You spent 3 years on the bench as a JV coach. And before that, you were an assistant boys basketball coach at Shaw in East Cleveland. How did those two experiences help prepare you to take over as the head coach at AfroCentric?
Coaching at East Cleveland Shaw High School really helped shape the style of play that I wanted to play. when I became a head coach, because, you know, it, as you go across the state of Ohio, basketball is played so different depending on where you are. You know, what cities and different cities play different styles. You know, like in Cleveland, it was a guard heavy game and the games was fast paced, you know, and I love that. In Columbus, when I came to Columbus, Columbus always seemed to always have bigs. They always had guys. They always had some bigs, some post players. And so they didn't quite play as fast until the Brookhaven teams came around. Down in Cincinnati, you know, with the GCL, it was grind them out, play hard, be super physical, you know, low scoring games. So in coaching at Shaw and then coming to Columbus and coaching at Afrocentric under Mike Thornton, you know, I kind of got an idea of the type of style that I wanted to play that I thought that would match the players that I would be coaching. And so that's the one thing I loved about Shaw. We got to see a lot of different styles in Cleveland, you know, because we played against Cleveland Heights and we played against Lakewood and we would play against Brush and Shaker and Lorraine. You know, you just saw all these different styles and teams and it really helped me open my eyes to the different styles of play, the different ways that you could play basketball. And then coaching under Mike Thornton, Mike was real good at like team building, real good at team building. He did a phenomenal job of being able to take a group of young men and bring them all together with different activities and different things that he would do with them in order to kind of get them to start meshing and to work together as one. And I took that from him. You know, any great coach will tell you that they get a lot of their ideas from other coaches. You know what I'm saying? And they just kind of change and tweak things to match what they want them to do. And I was able to do that at Shaw. And I was able to do that at Shaw. And my head coach at Shaw at the time was Leon Hines, Coach Leon Hines. And shout out to Coach Leon Hines for giving me my first opportunity to be a varsity basketball coach or assistant coach. And then Mike Thornton also for giving me that opportunity to be his JV coach at Afrocentric and help him start the program at Afrocentric. I've been on the bench for every varsity basketball game in Afrocentric school history, so I'm extremely proud of that.
Well, Coach, in 2007, you were named the head coach at Afrocentric. Take us back to that moment in time. Talk to us a little bit about the state of the program when you took it over. Share with our listeners, especially, you know, we're in hiring season, right? So a lot of coaches are getting set to take over a program for either the first time or maybe getting set to take over a new program. Talk about some of those things you did early on at Afrocentric that you feel as though has contributed to the success that your team is still experiencing 17 years later.
The biggest thing I think I did coming in right away was I thought that I thought it was really important. Well, first of all, let's start right from there. So we had just came back. I don't know if you remember this. Well, a lot of people, they talk about it every year we get into the Final Four. But in 2005, we had a state, our team at Afrocentric won the state championship in 2005 under Mike Thornton. And we unfortunately had our state championship. It had to be forfeited. And they said it was due to an ineligible player, but the player wasn't ineligible. The kid had a 3.4 grade point average. He didn't do anything wrong. He wasn't anything done illegally by any of the players or their parents or anything like that. It's just our athletic director at the time didn't turn in a piece of paperwork issue. Unfortunately, it was an adult problem. It wasn't a kid issue or it was a situation that shouldn't have happened. And so we lost that championship. Well, they took it from us. And then the next year we lost in the district championship game. And then Mike got offered the job at Harvest Prep. And then so I came in at that time. So when I took over the program, we still in that it was still that kind of cloud hanging over our program of the state championship being taken away. And so it was tough at the very beginning. The first thing that I did was I created a logo for our boys basketball team that was just different from what they were doing earlier. So, you know, I kind of came in first off and I wanted to just rebrand it all. I just wanted to start it all from scratch and start with something brand new. And this is the route that we're going to go. So that was the first thing I did is I rebranded what Afrocentric basketball would look like just in regards to just the logo and stuff like that. Next, I really wanted to come in and I brought people around me that I trusted. Okay, so my first assistant coach that I hired was my brother, Jason. Jason was my first hire as my assistant coach. And then my second assistant coach hire is still with me today, and that's Nashawn Coleman. you know, and that is, that was the best thing that I could do. And that's the best thing any coach, especially a first year coach, can do when they first take over a program, is surround yourself with people that you trust and people that you believe in and that believe in you and what you, and what you're trying to do. Because it's going to be a lot of people out there that are going to be naysayers, and it's going to be people out there that wanted the job and didn't think that you deserved that job. And so with all that negativity going on outside around you, you want to make sure that everything inside is all helping you to try to work this mission that you all have set for yourself. And so I think that's one of the biggest things that I did. Like I said, the rebranding, bringing in people that I trusted, not people that people, you know, not coaches that it was like, hey, I think this guy would be a great guy for your program and this, that, and the other, and I didn't know him. It's like, no, I had to go with people that I knew first, and then I could branch out after. I thought that was super important for us. And then that first year, we were fortunate. We still had some talent in the pipeline, and we were able to win a district championship my first season. And we went up to BG. We went to BG, and we played a team that had, it was Liberty Benton. And it was Aaron Kraft. It was his freshman year. And we lost to them in the district, in the regional semifinals, my first year. I'll never forget that, because he was a freshman and he was so good. He was so good at the time. And so, you know, I think just starting off, you want to rebrand. You want to, if you got a new program, you want to start off, you want to rebrand. You want to send out messages to people that this is different. It's a new day here, so on and so forth. But then when you do that, you also want to have people around you that believe in that idea, that you trust, so that you can really start working that plan when things are going well, and then when, especially when things aren't going so well.
So, Coach, as we head into the off season here, you know, what does April and May look like for your program, you know, especially as we try to get some momentum going into June, a very important month for basketball in Ohio?
Yeah, well, we're going to start off. We always kind of start off, we get in that weight room. You know, that's been a big focus for us the last few years. Get in that weight room starting in April. You know, we got these 28 days off. And after we come back from the 28 days, we'll start in that weight room. Then we'll start with shooting. You know, we want to have our players shooting. I try to get them to a certain number per week. You know, I want them to get up at least 500 makes, or I want you to get up 1,000 shots. You know, we're trying to, you know, just create times where kids can get in the gym and just get shots up, just to keep them sharp. Because a lot of our students, still have our student athletes play AAU. So they're going on the weekends most of the time. And some of them have practices during the week. And then we have kids that run track. And then we have kids that play baseball. You know what I mean? So we got all these kids doing all these different activities. So we want to allow them the opportunity to still shine in all those other sports. Because I think being a multi-sport athlete has been overshadowed here lately. You know, I think back in the days, most kids played multiple sports and it was encouraged to play multiple sports. And then we kind of got away from it for a few years. Probably before COVID, it was a lot more people that were more just singularly focused on one sport. You know, I think coming out of COVID, we got more kids playing more sports now. And I think that is going to be better for our kids. I think they have less injury history if they play multiple sports. But one of the big keys, I think, for them playing multiple sports is they learn how to win, where they learn how to be great teammates, where they learn how to think the games better because they're in more situations. The more situations and experiences that we give our student athletes, I think it's just better for them overall. So we'll start off, you know, a lot of shooting, a lot of weightlifting in April. And then May, we start picking up open gyms. We'll start picking up open gyms, just getting them loose, getting them out there a little bit to gear up for May, that end of May and that June basketball.
So, Coach, we've talked about players and how your players are getting better. How are you personally getting better, your staff getting better? What does your professional development look like in the off season?
In the off season, you know, I learned this from my dad. This is something I did get from my dad. I don't miss the Ohio Basketball Coaches Association clinic every fall. Never miss that. That's all. You got to make that every single year. There are always so many good things that you can get from a coach's clinic. Absolutely love the coaches that we bring in to gain that information from. Other thing that I do is I actually take my staff. My staff, we actually went to the the DC Coaches Clinic. So I'm encouraging my staff to go to Coaches Clinics as well. We went to the DC Coaches Clinic, the Wooten Coaches Clinic down in DC at Bishop O'Connell High School. We've went there. I've gone to Coaches Clinics at, I went to the Michigan Coaches Clinic, Basketball Coaches Clinic, and then the one in Indiana is coming up in April. So I like to go to Coaches Clinics. It's something about seeing those college coaches working with those players on court and talking through things, you know, that give you just different perspective and give you some ideas about what you could possibly do with your program. Also, in the offseason or in the preseason, I'm fortunate that I'm in Columbus and I get to go to Ohio State practices, men practices. I go to their practices all the time. I probably go about once or twice a week until our season starts. The reason why I go to those is I'm looking for offensive concepts. I'm looking for some defensive drills. I'm looking for ways to keep my practices engaging and new for my players. Almost any Division I coach, but even D2 and D3 coaches in our area, you know, Coach Winters over at Otterbein is awesome about allowing you to come to his practices. Same thing with Coach Godwin over at Capital University. He does a great job. He'll let you come to practices as well. Coach Michael Mills down at Wilmington, he runs great practices as well. I like to go to college coaches' practices and just try to get some ideas. I love to hear their terminology, what they use, the terminology that they use, because I want my kids, hopefully, that when my kids leave Afrocentric, when they do have the opportunity to go play at the next level on a collegiate team, that they're not thrown off by different new terms or different drills. Like they feel confident coming in that they were adequately prepared to step on that court and be able to perform right away. So, you know, I take great pride in going to the professional development opportunities, the coaches clinics here in town. But then also, like I said, I want to get on the road and then just going to those college coaches, to their gyms and their practices. And it's the same, I'm sure, if you're in Toledo, you know, the University of Toledo practices will be open. Or if you're in Cleveland State and University of Dayton, I've went to their practices before. So I go to a lot of college coaches' practices in the off season to try to get some ideas and try to bring something back to the program to keep us fresh.
Yeah, I think that's one thing. We're fortunate here in Ohio, you know, the brotherhood and sisterhood of coaches, that there is no shortage of resources for us as coaches.
No doubt.
If you're not taking something new back to your team every year, you did something wrong, because we're very fortunate with that. And hopefully this next question we have for you, there might be some coaches tuning in that can maybe take something that you share with us. So let's dive into the X's and O's a little bit, if you don't mind.
Sure.
The first topic we'd like to discuss is your defensive philosophy at Afrocentric. Kind of a two-part question here. How do you get your guys to play so hard on the defensive side of the ball? And maybe take us through how you build your full court pressure defensive system.
Okay. If you want to play hard, you got to practice hard. Like, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And if you want to play fast, you have to practice fast. And I believe if you ask most kids, say, hey, you want to play fast or you want to play slow? They want to play fast. And I want to play fast too. But in order to play fast, we got to practice fast. We got to practice hard. So that's the one thing, is it's like we got to buy into this together. You know, if this is how we want to play, then these are the things that we have to do. And so practices are built to be full court. So my practices are built full court. Everything about our practices is full court. So we're going full court on everything. I'm not one of those guys. We don't just run the run. So, you know, because if you want to, we want to defend people 94 feet. Period, point blank. Even if we play zone, and we played a lot of zone this particular year, even in zone, when we play zone, we want to still pick up 94 feet. So, you know, if I'm playing a matchup zone, we match up zone 94 feet. And so even when you're in that, you have to practice that. And so everything that we do, when we're doing layups are always full court layups. You know, if we're doing passing drills, they're always full court passing drills, just so that they can get used to running up and down that court constantly the whole game. So that's our way of preparing our bodies for the physical demands of playing 94 feet, is that we practice everything is 94 feet. Everything is 94 feet. Anytime we're working on ball handling, it's 94 feet. If we're working on defending the ball, we're zigzag. We work zigzag drill. Our zigzag drill is going to be 94 feet. It's full court, you know, the whole time. So everything is just built off of that. That's the first thing. Second big concept is probably going to be that we want to shrink the court. Because we're playing 94 feet, we need to, you know, there's a lot of space in between players when you're playing 94 feet. And so in order to make your opponent feel like there's not a lot of room on that court, you have to shrink the court. And then so, you know, we have to start teaching them how to play interceptors, how to play in passing lanes, how to read the shoulders of the offensive player, because the offensive player can kind of show you which direction he's going to pass based on which way his shoulders are turned. You know, not paying attention to their pivot feet and looking at their trunk as opposed to looking at their feet. You know what I'm saying? Like little stuff like those things are the things that we kind of mention and talk about in practice. But when you're building up pressure defense, you know, everything needs to be 94 feet. That's all. You know, if you can start it there, then you'll be able to end it there. You know, you got to start it there, though. You got to start 94 feet. If you don't start, every drill needs to be that distance. You know what I mean? And 94 feet is what I'm saying to them constantly out loud so that they understand, like, this is how we want to play it constantly. And then eventually they become sophomores and juniors, and now they just doing it naturally. They just picking up naturally because it's just what we do.
Well, Coach, let's transition to the offensive end now. Because I think, you know, from my experiences and watching basketball, you know, the deeper you get into the regular season and in the tournament play, a lot of games come down to whether or not you can execute in the half court, right?
Most,
like you're going to pressure teams. And I'm sure a lot of times, like, you're just hoping to wear them down throughout the course of the game, right? You know, maybe you'll get a steal here and there, but at the end of the day, hey, listen, we're not getting beat up the court. Like I said, we're trying to shrink the court. We're not letting them have openings, keep the ball in front of you. Let's just constantly wear on that point guard that maybe in the fourth quarter, you know, he makes that costly turnover, or maybe that two doesn't have any more legs because he's been dealing with full court pressure the whole time.
Comes up
short on that shot. But so in that, the game's coming down to more of a half court game. You've stated in previous conversations that you've kind of been a dribble drive guy in the past. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of teams say they're dribble drive, whether or not they're really dribble drive is another question. But what has made that offense effective for you? And what are 3 to 4 key principles of your dribble drive offense that you're constantly talking to your kids about?
Dribble drive for us works because it also works hand in hand with full court pressure defense. You know what I mean? Because it's a push and a pull. So because we're pushing that thing full, you know, at them full court, and we're playing 94 feet full court on defense, you know, when we get the ball, we're bringing that ball right back at you as fast as we possibly can. You know what I'm saying? Because I really want to get into a one-on-one, two-on-two type situations full court. If we can play one-on-one, two-on-two, ooh, I like my chances. You know what I'm saying? I really love my chances when we can play one-on-one, two-on-two. And so we're going to push that thing right back at you quickly. But if you retreat and you get back and you get us covered, what I do love about dribble drive is, number one thing is, it gives the guy with the ball the opportunity to make a play. And that's what I like. With the students that I service, okay, urban, especially, you know, I'm keep it honest, urban kids, with my urban students, athletes that I have, you know, a lot of times, you know, they're aggressive. They can go. They're quick with the ball. You know what I'm saying? I want to put an offense in that allowed them to use some of those physical gifts that they have. And so with them being able to handle the ball the way that some of them can handle it, and with the level of quickness that they have, you know, I think that the dribble drive was able to put pressure. It's really able to put a lot of pressure on people to defend and cause a lot of help. You know what I mean? And you know, when you're doing dribble drive, it's not so much that the guy dribbling can easily get a layup as much as the drive causes the defense to shift and help, which then allows for an opening that, you know, that we try to attack that second opening. And if that causes a help, then now it causes a third opening. Now we're looking for that easy shot. You know what I'm saying? And so the one thing that I love about the dribble drive is if we can get into those gaps and cause that help to happen, it gives us opportunities to give up good shots for great shots. And so number one concept for me on the dribble drive is you got to be strong on your straight line drives. You got to be strong. So, you know, you can't get knocked off your line easily. You know, you got to be able to put pressure in your straight line drives. You got to be able to get into that paint. You got to be able to get a foot into that paint on straight line drives. That's concept number one for us. Concept number two for us is guys in a corner, they have to be patient, okay? So the guys in the corner, they have to read what the guy dribbling is going to be doing. And so he has to be patient, because a lot of times if I drive and I get stopped, you know, sometimes the person in the corner, they have to read what their defender is doing. If the defender helped, now I might be able to you know, just move up the lane a little bit and get myself into a nice open position for a good, easy shot. If my man really steps up to help, then I might be able to go back door. So, you know, the guys in the corner, they have to be patient and be able to read what the defender is going to do. So, you know, point number one is good, hard, straight line drives. Number two is guys in the corner got to be patient so that they can make the correct read. Then I think rule number three, the third principle, is that we always got to have somebody filling in behind. We got to have somebody filling in the gap that was just left. And so when a guy drives in straight line, we want to have somebody filling in that spot that they just left from, because that's usually an easy throwback pass. That's an easy pass that helps you get quicker to your next level of attack. Those three things are super important: hard straight line drives, patient reading what the defender does in the corner, and then always filling in that gap. Those three things can really help you move that ball side to side. And you know, my brother Jason says this all the time to me, you know, first side maybe in half court offense, first side maybe, second side possibly, but third side definitely. So first side, you may get a good shot. Maybe you get a good shot. Second side, you probably gonna get a good shot. But you get it back to the third side, you definitely gonna get a good shot. So that's some of those principles in the dribble drive that help us. If we can get to that third side, we usually get great, great shot attempts.
So, Coach, I want to follow up on a couple things with that, but I just, for our listeners, I want to review your three key principles. One, we got to be strong on straight line drives. We can't get bumped off that line. Two, the guys in the corner have to be patient. You're reacting to the ball handler and what the ball handler does. And then three, you always got to make sure you have that safety, that guy filling in behind when there's a drive. Am I correct on those three?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay, so here's two more questions. One, what are you doing with your post player if you have one? So is it a four out, one in look, or are you going a five out look? And if it's a four out, one in look, are you keeping that post opposite the ball? Are they in that dunker spot, or are they more block area, or are they ball side? And then two, when you go about installing it, you know, I'm sure 2 years previous, you know, it was probably pretty quick with your review, and then you could just add to it. But this year had a new team, right? So you're maybe starting at the beginning. Or how are you installing that? Are you showing it, then doing breakdowns and putting it back together? Are you doing breakdowns first and building up to it? What's your practice plan look like for building a dribble drive?
Cool. Thank you for asking that, man. Thank you, because I did leave some stuff out. So we are in dribble drive. We four out, one in. Post is always opposite the ball, because once again, on a straight line drive, we want to cause help. And if we get a good step up, if we get past that first guy, and then the big man, that post guy, has to step up to help, that makes it for an easy little dump off pass, whether it be a bounce pass, pocket pass, or a little lob to our post player right there. So we're always off ball. We'd be opposite. Post is always opposite the ball.
Coach, when you're okay, so let's just ask and trying to visualize. So
sure,
talk about a baseline drive, and then talk about a middle drive. What's your post movement on a baseline drive? What's your post movement on a middle drive?
On a baseline drive, the post is already opposite the ball. So on a baseline drive, my post is stepping up to like the front of the rim. So like if it was a, if we had a restriction line on the college court, they got the restraining line for the lane. We'd be right on top of that restraining line, like right there. We call it the tee up position. All right. So the tee up position. So that's where that is. If we had somebody to tee up, we would have them run to that spot. So on the baseline drive, we're going to clear out the baseline so that we might have that float pass along the baseline. So we got to take that post guy and tee him up. So get him to the front of the rim. So that gives us two options, or actually three options for that guy that's driving to have. He got the shot. He got to give it to the post at the tee up spot, or he can try to hit that baseline float pass. So we got that one on the baseline drive. On a middle drive, okay, so we're driving at where the post player is. So he's already opposite. We're driving middle. Post is going to take two hard steps, and then kind of set up and kind of jump across the lane. I could show it to you better than I can explain it to you. But we're going to drive at him. He's going to take two steps across the baseline to the other post to try to set himself up for a passing spot in that area. So, yeah, we want to see. So he's going to go opposite that ball. So if he's driving at him, he's going to come to the other side.
So basically on a baseline drive, you have your post essentially circle up. And on a middle drive, they're circling under.
Yes. Adam, that was very well said, man. I got to write that down for myself.
Well,
write that down. I got to put that in my notes, my personal notes. I just have professional development right now.
I got a lot of friends in Columbus that want to know, that want a free scouting report on you, so I'm trying to help them out. And then, Coach, the last question would be, what's your practice look like? How are you building it?
So that's something we got to do every day, because everything about dribble drive is really instinctual and is really reactive. You know what I mean? A lot of it is reacting to what the defense does based on the movement that you made. And so the only way that the kids can get comfortable in how to read those things is to constantly be putting them in those opportunities to have the opportunity to read and react to these different situations. And so we do a lot of 4-on-4 shell, where we'll have the defense, we'll tell the defense to try to defend it different ways. So, you know, we'll run 4-on-4 shell where we'll try to defend, where we'll switch. We'll try to run some of our 4-out actions. So like we'll do our 4-on-4 shell with all guards, and we just won't have that post player in there. Okay. And that way they get used to the runs and the moves and where they're supposed to be. We build it up in practice. So we'll kind of start off 2-on-0. Working on what those movements look like. So if one guy is straight line driving, we got another guy that's maybe next to him that will then come back in and drag in behind him so that we have that field spot, so that we can always have that spot field when the guy just left. Sometimes we'll drive straight in and we'll have one guy in the corner, one guy at the top, and then we'll drive in, and then we'll get either the baseline cut, backdoor cut, or we'll do the little lift action, where we'll pitch it, and then we'll start building it up. We'll start in 2, then we'll build it up to 3, then we'll build it up to 4. And that'll be 4-on-0, 2-on-0, 3-on-0, 4-on-0, right? We'll do that for 10 minutes. Then we'll go 10 minutes, 4-on-4, shell. Same thing. They got to score. And it's competitive. Kids absolutely love it, because it's something on the line. You got to compete, you know, and it's something on the line. And so, you know, we keep in score. Everything is competitive. Everything is the black team versus the white team. And if you lose, you know, depending on the day and how I feel and what kind of day I had. So, you know, sometimes it's, you know, a down and back. That's a good day. Then the other day, we missed too many free throws the night before. And it might be for a 134, which is like 8 up and down, full court, 8. And then you do 8 full courts. And then you come back, and then you'll run the old school, like, suicide afterwards. So it's like, boom, all back to back. And you got to do it in a minute and 32 seconds or a minute and 34 seconds. They absolutely hate that. So nobody wants to do that. So when we go 4-on-4, it is a battle. It is a flat out battle in practice. And this is the big thing. And this is one of the things I encourage all coaches that want to do dribble drive. You got to put your post players out there with the guards too. You got to let them run those same spots. Let them learn how to do those same things. Even though they probably not going to do it, they'll understand what those guards are thinking about when they're on the floor. And so if they have an understanding of what those guards are thinking about and what the reads are for them, it'll help them be better in finding the holes and the openings that can help them be more effective and put themselves in a better opportunity to score. We do a lot of that in practice. We do 4-on-4. Then we'll do some up and backs where we'll go 5-on-5-on-0, full court transition, 5-on-0. We'll run straight into, you know, all of our transition sets run into dribble drive sets. So every one of my transition calls is actually one of our dribble drive motion sets. And so we'll just run through those 5-on-0 for about 5 minutes. And then we'll come back and we'll go 5-on-5. And once again, put something on the line with it. And so that's what kind of practice looks like. So we'll do we do a little dribble drive session and practice every day for about 30 minutes on the offensive side and the skill building. And then also just teaching reads and how to play the offense.
Adam, I think we should consider this as our first episode that we charge people to listen to. Some of the jewels that Coach Bates is dropping here, I mean, are just outstanding. I mean, that little chalk talk session we just had, Coach, bravo. That was awesome.
Appreciate it.
That was awesome. So, Coach, you kind of touched on this a little bit with your, you know, the people around you and your support staff, your assistant coaching staff. I kind of wanted to unpack that answer a little bit more. So, you know, now being head coach at Afrocentric for the past 17 years, as you said, you've had some good people around you that have helped you build what it is today. Talk a little bit about those individuals, and in your opinion, what are some of those qualities and characteristics that make a great assistant coach?
I'm going to be totally honest with you, man. I couldn't have built this program at all without my brother, first off. And he was with me for the first 2 years, and Nashawn Coleman. Nashawn Coleman is like my right-hand man. Like, it is unbelievable. This program is not what it is today without Nashawn Coleman. And so, amazing, amazing basketball mind. We bounce off of each other. We bounce ideas off of each other big time. He's been there, like I said, every step of the way. I think one of the biggest qualities of assistant coaches is that they're not afraid to share their opinions. You know, I think it's sometimes as head coaches, we don't really empower our assistant coaches. You know what I'm saying? We got assistant coaches, but we don't really empower them. You know what I mean? Like, to give them to make them feel like that their opinion on whatever it is, it really means something to you. You know what I mean? I think it's super important that anybody that I have that's an assistant coach for me, if they can't tell me what they honestly believe and they don't feel like they can tell me what they honestly believe, then I don't want them to be one of my assistant coaches. I don't want any yes men around me. I don't need yes men. I need people that are going to help me build great basketball players. And we're not always going to have the same opinion about it. We're not going to always have the same ideas about how to get to a certain destination. But in having the conversations about why you think the way that you think, and then I have to then, as the head coach, then explain to you why I want to do it the way that I want to do it. It helps me to further know that, yes, what I want to do is the right thing to do, or it lets me know, like, hey, wait a minute, I didn't think about that. Let me rethink that a little bit. And so I think it's super important to empower your assistant coaches. So because if you got a great team, we can, you know, I can make a great decision. I think I can make a pretty good decision by myself, but I'm way more confident about that decision if I make that decision with my 5 or 6 assistant coaches. I think that's super important. And so, you know, 6 minds is going to be better. 6 minds are going to come together and make a much better decision than one mind is. And so I think it's super important for me to empower those assistant coaches to do that. And I've had some great assistant coaches over the years, but Nashawn Coleman been with me since day one. And my current staff, Anthony Miller, Tommy Williams, Mike Menchaca, Kenny Lee, Javon, Javon Walker, Houston Smith, these guys have been absolutely phenomenal to the success that we've had over the last 5 years. I just feel like I got one of the best coaching staffs in the business. So I'm extremely proud of them guys. But I think as an assistant coach and as a head coach, I think it's super important that we empower our assistant coaches to really tell us what they think. You know, they got some great ideas in their heads, and they see our players, and they might see some things that we don't see, or they may connect with players in a way that we can't connect. And they might have some information for us that we can't get for ourselves. And I think it's super important that we get everybody's input, because if we get everybody's input, we're going to come up with a great decision. And it's going to be best, not just best for us as a staff, but it's going to be best for our kids as players in our program. Totally. So, yeah, I think it's super important for that.
Coach, I love that phrase, empowering. I love the phrase. That is awesome. So we'd like to transition to a little segment we do here called Triple Threat.
We're
going to give you three topics and let you share your thoughts, ideas, experiences, maybe just the first thing that comes to mind. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. First question in the Triple Threat package. The toughest player or maybe the toughest team you've had to prepare a scouting report for?
Shoot, we done played a lot of really good teams over the years. A lot of great players. Oh, shoot.
I know you mentioned Aaron Kraft earlier when he was a freshman.
I can go down a list. Aaron Kraft. Chris Wright that played at University of Dayton. Adrian Payne that played at Michigan State. Jerome Hunter. He was at Xavier Pick North with Jason Adolphus, Washington, Von Cameron Davis, like Tavion Kinsley playing in the league right now. Like, we played against so many great teams and players over the years. But if I had to pick one right off the top of my head, first one comes to mind for me, Colin White, Ottawa Glandorf. One of the best players we've played against. He just always was productive. Every time we played him, he just produced. You know, everything that we read on the scouting report, everything we put was always right. It was exactly on. Nothing was left off. He just produced. You know what I'm saying? He just produces. I shouldn't say he produced. He's producing. Four times going to the – I think I read a tweet somewhere today where he is one of two players in the state of Ohio that have started 4 years on teams that went to the Final Four. They were a starter on a team that went to the Final Four times. Like, kid is amazing. Had an absolutely a phenomenal high school career. And like I said, the first thing come to my mind, he would be the one. Just always difficult because I couldn't beat him. We didn't beat him, you know. He was one of the only ones that we couldn't beat. Him and Devin Royal, those two come to mind.
Well, those are two really good players.
Yeah, right.
And I'm glad they're staying in Ohio. I'm glad we got them at Ohio State. And the other kid that, you know, Chris said Colin was one of two. The other guy was a well-known guy in LeBron James.
Most definitely.
That was the other one.
Yeah.
So, Coach, let's talk about real quick the new 5-team foul bonus rule. Did it do anything for you this year? Did it change the dynamic or change the way you play? Or did you notice anything with it?
Third quarter went by real fast this year, fellas. You know what I mean? Like, third quarters, they really flew past. You know what I'm saying? It didn't slow it down. Like, I don't know very many teams that got into the shooting the bonus in the third quarter this year. You know what I mean? Like in just researching and looking at my games, it wasn't a lot of times that people were shooting a lot of free throws in the third quarter. It just didn't. Fourth quarter, yes, because we're getting closer to the end of the game, but the third quarter kind of flew past. That's one thing that I noticed. Not that that means anything, but it's just something that I noticed personally. Like, third quarters went by really fast. Wasn't a lot of free throws shot in the third quarters this year. All right. I thought that the two-shot fouls at the end, I missed one-on-ones. I missed a couple of one-on-ones. You got rewarded defensively for fouling. You know what I'm saying? And so I kind of missed that when you're down. You know, you kind of had that opportunity where they had to make the free throws. You know what I'm saying? And so when they were making one-on-ones, so I kind of missed the one-on-ones a little bit. But the two-shot fouls, you know, like I said, I didn't really see much difference in the game per se. I thought the games played a little bit faster this year, though. I did think that the games weren't as slow as they have been in the past.
All right, Coach. Third question: your favorite coach or team to watch at a higher level, and why?
It's a couple coaches. A couple coaches that I really like to watch. I really love watching Shaka Smart coach teams. especially not necessarily Texas Shaka Smart, but the VCU and then now the Marquette Shaka Smart. Oh, I love those teams. I love watching them play. I think they play extremely intelligently on offense. I love that but it's an intelligent pressure on offense. Like, they are constantly coming at you offensively. You know what I mean? It's not slow, grind it down. They're coming at you, but it's like intelligently coming at you. And then the pressure on the defensive side, I just love that type of pressure on defense. You know, it becomes like a mano-a-mano type situation, and just like putting kids in those situations where, look, you gotta step up, you gotta show and prove. You know, I like giving them those opportunities to shine in those moments. And so I really love watching Shaka Smart coach teams. I really like watching those teams play. And then I like watching Sean Miller teams and Xavier, of course.
Absolutely. Well, Coach, we have one more question for you. But before we get to that, just want to say thank you for coming on the show tonight and spending some time with Walt and I on the Holding Court podcast.
I appreciate it, man. Like it was unbelievable when I was given the opportunity to come on the podcast. I was extremely excited about it because I've watched the podcast for the last year or so that you've been on. I've been watching the podcast, and so to be able to come on and share, like I said, share some of my ideas about basketball and Afrocentric, share some information, insight about Afrocentric basketball and myself as a person. I really wanted to thank you for giving me that platform and the opportunity.
Well, Coach, the question's really simple. Walt and I, you know, we both believe this, that in order to be successful in this profession, if you have family, they got to be along for the ride. And in preparing for the podcast and talking to you, you more than once mentioned your wife and your daughter. Talk about your family a little bit in that statement that, you know, if you're going to be successful, they got to be along for the ride. And then how do you find that balance, especially during the season, between basketball and your family? Because as coaches, we can sit here and say it's easy. It's not.
No.
If you want to be really good at what you do, it's not. For coaches, the whole work-life balance thing, yeah, I don't buy it. Like, it's hard. So how do you manage it and make it work?
Very fortunate. First of all, when I kind of started coaching, my daughter was a little bit, wasn't as younger. You know, she's really my coaching, and the amount of time that I spend coaching basketball really kind of took off when she kind of got to high school a little bit. You know what I'm saying? So I had a little bit more time away, a time to do it. My wife is a principal of a school. So, you know, evenings, early evenings, you know, she spends a lot of time at work. So, like, when I'm working basketball, she really works extra hard at what she does, so that when we both get home, I think our biggest thing is that when we both get home from work, whether, you know, her in the principal job and me with teaching in the daytime and then basketball in the evenings, that when we do get home, we're not still working. I think that's important, that when we get home, that the time spent at home is just the time spent where we're talking and spending time with one another, and not, I'm not just at home watching film and sitting next to her and she's, you know what I'm saying, she's on her cell phone and I'm on my iPad watching game film. You know, it's when we get home, it's time, you know, how was your day? How was my day? And we kind of talking and just kind of ironing things out and just talking about what's going on at her job. I think it's super important as coaches. You know, a lot of times we can get consumed with everything that's going on with our programs and everything going on with our kids and everything going on with what's happening with our kids and their families and their houses. You know what I mean? A lot of times people forget about that. Like, as coaches, sometimes we become like surrogate dads and, you know, real important uncles to a lot of these young men and women that we with all the time. So a lot of times it's easy to bring that home with you as well. So I think it's super important to get home and ask her how her day is going and spend time talking about what she got going on. And then just being at home, I don't like to talk a lot of basketball with her, you know what I mean? Because I would, if she would listen, I would. But she ain't trying to hear it. And I know she's not trying to hear it, so I ain't really talking about it. But try to talk about other stuff with her when I get home. But I don't really want to do anything with basketball or work when we get home together and spend a little bit of time in the evenings with one another. My daughter, like I said, she's been in high school, college. She's a third year PhD student at the University of Wisconsin and Madison. And super proud of her. I always call her before every game, you know, just to tell her that I'm nervous, and she'll just talk to me about something else and take my mind off of it. And so that's kind of like our little thing. So she's always been a part of the basketball scene, but in a way where she's like my support person. Like I kind of call her when I'm nervous so I can think about something else other than this game that's about to happen or whatever the case may be. So, you know, it's just been fun to include them in parts of basketball, but then they're able to take me away from basketball too, which is super important. I think that's the big thing. I don't want them to just come and be with me all on the basketball side. I want them to stay doing the things that they do and then let me come ask them about that. Let me go over and check out what y'all doing over here. You know what I mean? Like, to take my mind off of basketball and put my mind on whatever it is that they're doing. I think that helps with that work-life balance part. And then in the summertime, fellas, whenever I get it after June basketball, I'm a straight golfer. That's it. All I want to do is play golf. I don't want to do nothing else. I just want to play golf. I don't want to go do no workouts. I don't want to do no 6 a.m. workouts. I will do all of that stuff starting in September. But the month of July or August, I'm trying to hit that white. I'm trying to hit that little white golf ball as many times. No, I take that back. Not as many times. I'm trying to hit it a lot.
Trying to go to the course as many times as possible.
Exactly. That's what I mean.
Ball as few amount of times.
Yes, exactly.
I got you. I got you.
That's exactly what it's about.
I can respect that. Yep.
And that 4 hours that I'm playing golf and focusing on hitting that golf ball, I am not thinking about basketball. That's what I love about golf. You know what I mean? That my focus can be elsewhere. And so I think that it's super important that, you know, you have something that takes your focus elsewhere besides basketball.
Thanks for listening to Holding Court, presented by the Ohio High School Basketball Coaches Association. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. In the meantime, keep up with us on Twitter and Facebook at OhioBKCoaches, on Instagram at OHSBCA1947, and online at www.oh.nhsbca.org. Until next time.